Welcome to Circuit Break from Macrofab, a weekly show about all things engineering, DIY projects, manufacturing, industry news, and automating PCB design. We're your hosts, electrical engineers Parker Dolman
and Stephen Craig.
This is episode 421. Circuit Break from Macrofab. Hey, Circuit Breakers. We have an announcement. We're running an electronic design contest on our community forums. The theme is food devices. Go to forum.macrofab.com to find out more information about the contest and how to enter. There's a category on the left side of the forum that says contests. Click that. You'll find it. For prizes, there's over $5,000 in cash and free prototyping services through Macrofab. And the most important thing, a trophy to show that your design was one of the best entered. There'll be a link in the show notes where to find more information about this contest and how to enter. And thank you, Mauser Electronics, for sponsoring the contest.
This episode, our guest is Sergey Nestorenko. Sergey is the founder of Quilter, a startup focused on automating PCB layout. Before Quilter, Sergey was a senior avionics engineer at SpaceX, focused on the Falcon 9 Falcon Heavy second stage in high radiation environments. Sergey holds a triple major in mathematics, physics, and chemistry from UC Berkeley.
Welcome to the podcast, Sergey.
Parker, Steven, thank you guys so much for having me.
And we were talking a little bit before the podcast about you were working on radiation protection and components for a rocket, and now you're doing basically automating PCB design. How did you decide you wanted to go do that? Like, did you do layouts before SpaceX, or what's the process there? The history?
Yeah. There's a few elements that went into this. So my first PCB or my first actual layout was at SpaceX. I built a lot of electronics before, but I, used breadboards or perf boards or whatever else and just hand soldered stuff. And one of my first tasks at SpaceX was actually still in the EMI group. This was before I came over to Radiation Effects, was to break out a soft start switch from the Falcon 9 power system and hook it up to some automated test equipment. And that was my first time opening up Altium and trying to figure out how to do a PCB and how to do layout. And as I was doing it, I asked myself, why isn't a computer doing this? And then I clicked the button and I saw why a computer wasn't doing this. And I proceeded to do it manually, and I proceeded to build, more than 100 boards for both SpaceX and personal projects after that. So, later after I left SpaceX, I got an opportunity to start a company, thought about different problems I might solve, and eventually started thinking, what is something I know is a real problem that I saw at SpaceX that I think I can tackle? And this was it.
You said you opened up Altium and clicked a button, and there was sort of the aha moment the way you presented it in terms of, oh, this is why a computer doesn't do it. I'm curious if you could go a little bit further into that. Like, what about it was that the computer wasn't doing what you wanted it to do?
Yeah, totally. So what we're talking about for the avid listener will be autorouters, right? That's kind of the standard thing that people think about when they're thinking about automated PCB layout. And there's a bunch of things that went wrong for me and go wrong in general with these things. So the first is just quite literally that they don't handle the whole process, right? So when you think about a layout, you're really starting with, a schematic and some constraints. What is the size of your board? Where do you want connectors or buttons or monitors or whatever else? And you're going all the way through fab files. Like, how do we actually go and get this manufactured and get this board on my desk? Autorouter is typically just considered with connected dots, right? It's not including placement, it's not including stack up, it's not including kind of high level planning of, mixed signal and whatever else. And then, of course, importantly, it's not including the considerations of simulations and did we actually get it right? So the main things that bothered me are, it's not tackling the whole process end to end. Even when it is, for most boards of any complexity, you don't get a full solution, right? Autorouters don't typically get to 100%, and you're kind of left cleaning up the mess and trying to connect the rest. And then the most importantly, and the thing that I think is the worst about autorouters today, is that you have to review their work. You have to look at all the traces and ask yourself, is this actually going to function? Are we going to overheat stuff? Are we going to have crosstalk issues? Are we going to be susceptible to radiation susceptibility or emissions and so on and so forth? And that can be as difficult or more difficult than just doing it yourself and doing it right. And that's why, in my experience, they're just not used, practically speaking.
When you went to make your first board, was that your expectation that you jump in and press a button and it kind of the hamster starts going?
You know, it wasn't, but simply because I was on a floor with 600 other electrical engineers and I could see their monitors. I could see that people were designing boards. I could see that this was happening on almost every computer around the house. And so I knew that this is a manual task. But as I started doing it, I just thought, well, hold on. Like, it would seem like a computer should be good at this. So why isn't it? And so my expectation came from like the first principles of doing, you know, placement, doing routing and asking, like, this seems automatable. But no, my expectation, given that everybody else was doing it manually, was that there's no easy answer to this and I was going to have to do it manually.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, computers are really good at pathfinding. And ideally, routing is pathfinding for the traces, at least. So if you're just doing that part, yeah, you would expect that a computer would be at least kind of decent at it. But yeah, no, it's not really good at it.
Actually, this is one of the misconceptions that I certainly had before I started this problem, and I find a lot of people had. You know, when I explain this problem of routing a board to somebody who's never done it before, I certainly make this analogy of like, okay, you have this maze and you're finding a path from A to B. And typically that specific problem is, you know, computer science 1A, right? That's a pretty basic algorithm. You do a grid or run Dijkstra or whatever. Not so hard. The hard part is that once you have a solution to that first maze, it becomes an obstacle to your next maze. And once you've done that 10,000 times on your 10,001st trace, how did you make sure that you have space for it? And that, I think, is something that humans are exceptionally good at because we've evolved in a three-dimensional world and we have capabilities to arrange things three-dimensionally and then plan and so on and so forth. And that's actually deceptively hard for a computer. That problem explodes so quickly that you can't brute force it. And coming up with heuristics for it, well, that's what autorouters have done today, and it doesn't work that well. So even forgetting the important stuff, even forgetting the physics, right, connect the dots on a dense 10,000-pin board is still hard for a computer. And it's because of that kind of compounding problem of your next maze solution has been blocked by all the previous solutions.
Yeah, I think the last time I actually used an autorouter was quite a while ago. But it would try a solution and then be like, well, didn't finish, so I'm just going to start over. And just, I guess it just tweaked the parameter and just ran it again. And I think the biggest thing was you can just set like how many iterations it could run. And I think I just set it up on the lab computer and just let it run over the weekend, which probably didn't make the TA really happy, but whatever.
Did it finish after the whole weekend?
No, it got to 94% routed.
Right.
Yeah.
It's an exponential difficulty increase, right? So making a router that gets to 50, 60, 70% is really easy. Getting to 95% is a little bit harder, but going from 99.9 to 100, that is the difference, right? That is the thing that's actually really, really difficult. And it's no surprise, right? I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, Parker, but I'm guessing that you looked at that 94% completed board, control A, delete, and restart.
Yeah, I started all over and I just did it myself.
Right. But if you hadn't, and I've done this experiment, if you hadn't, and you tried to finish that last 6%, you would have been shoving around, deleting, replacing, and redoing probably 20, 30, 40% of the traces that the autorouter did, which is why people don't do this.
Yeah, I've told my boss before, on a relatively simple board, I'll say, it's going to take me 3 days. The first day is get to 80%, the next day is to get to 98%, and then the last day is 4 traces. And that's, then you'll have a board.
Oh, spot on.
So yeah, we know like engineers just don't like autorouters because we have terrible experiences with them. Mm. And a lot of times they're just viewed as wastes of time. So how does Quilter go from the 98 to 100%?
Yeah, so I actually think that that's not sufficient even. So I find it helpful to talk about Quilter first from like a super long distant future of the dream of technology and then work backwards about like, how do we get there? And the thing that I find helpful is to draw inspiration from the software side of things. So when I work on Quilter, one of the analogies I tend to make, and I want to present this just because I come back to it all the time and I want to put some footing for it. I think of what we do as kind of the compiler for circuit boards. So roughly speaking, you can kind of argue that a schematic is a high-level human-readable representation of logic, right? Like what are your inputs, outputs, and functionality that you want from the board? And to a software engineer, that's a lot like writing Python or C++ or something like that, right? It's a human-readable language that's defining your functionality and constraints. But of course, in software, we can click a compile button And in hardware, we can't. In hardware, we have to take that logic that's in the schematic and make it real by hand, right? So I think about the inspiration for Quilter for, you know, let's call it the 100-year future, right? When computers and AI are so incredible that this is obviously going to be automated. I think about it as the compiler for hardware, right? Like, what happens when electrical engineers can focus just on schematics and high-level constraints and put their creativity into that piece? And then, like, layouts are so good from computers that it's nonsensical to even check them, right? Like in software, we don't look at the assembly that comes out. We don't look at the ones and zeros that are going into the registers of the processor. It's just going to work. It's going to be fine. Wasn't always that way. In the early days, autocode was equally regarded as something terrible, as something that's never going to work, as something that's inefficient, like the same stuff that we talk about with autorouters today. But today, like, could we imagine an operating system or a web browser or the internet or neural networks without a compiler? Like, that would be so inconceivable to do that all from assembly. So, like, the inspiration for what Quilter should be and what I wanted to create in this long distant future is the compiler for hardware. Like, what happens when we have that equivalent of a compiler that we can run and we lower the barrier to entry for electrical engineers significantly so that, you know, like a 10-year-old can go play with Python and make a website today. A 10-year-old's probably not doing a PCB. But when it gets that easy, like, what all are we going to build? So when I think about it from that perspective, like, it's not sufficient to just get to 100%. We really have to get to the point where it would be nonsensical to review the output of the layout the same way it is with a compiler. And that you have to get to 100%, no doubt. Like, if you didn't connect everything, the board's obviously not going to work. Like, what's the point? But you also have to make sure that the layout is as aware or more aware of the physics than humans, that it's factored in all the electromagnetics, all the thermodynamics, all the manufacturing processes, at least as well and ideally much better than a human can. And that's when we get to the kind of compiler vision of what it can be. And then, of course, the hard part is it's easier said than done. Like, how do we actually get there?
And that's what Quilter's trying to march towards?
Bingo. That's exactly right.
We've been having some discussions about AI and electronics at work recently. And just this concept that a PCB, especially just like a very simplistic square or rectangle PCB, is a very conceivable thing for a human. You can look at it and with enough brain power, you can understand it and dig through it. But it's also really well set up for humans to do that. AI doesn't have to have the constraints necessarily that a human does in terms of visibility or readability. And so there's this concept we've been talking about of AI-generated electronics that could potentially have far more organic shapes to them as it takes into account what you were talking about, like the actual physics behind things. And it may be entirely unintelligible shapes, things that you can't understand by even looking at it, but it actually functions most optimally.
Oh man, you touched the hot topic for me. That's very, very, very exciting. I'm glad you brought that up. I'll say a couple of things on this. So one of the most inspiring examples that I saw of this was actually some research done in FPGAs like 15 or 17 years ago. There was a lab that was interested in using genetic algorithms to configure FPGAs to basically do logic synthesis. Of like, all right, we feed in some, you know, some bits on the left, we expect certain bits on the right. FPGA, go configure yourself to make that true. And, you know, the genetic algorithm worked. Eventually, FPGA spit out the right answer. And the humans started looking at, like, well, what did it do? Like, let's go take apart. How did it actually do the logic here? And they saw that there was, like, a signal chain from the inputs to the outputs. Okay, that's great. They started shutting down the pieces that seemed unconnected. It stopped working. Then they turned those pieces on. Like, wait, it's working again. But, like, they're logically disconnected. Why is that happening? Loaded the program on a different FPGA. It didn't work. So what ended up happening is the genetic algorithm actually found parasitics within that FPGA such that the coupling path across different registers was producing the right answer. That is absolutely insane. So when I think about this, you know, I don't know if you guys have played at all with PCB filters, like trace filters, where you can do like high pass, low pass, band pass filters with just trace shapes. Super cool things. We tested some of our electromagnetic simulations against these. It makes me wonder, like, maybe there's a case where we make these arbitrary shapes where like traces aren't even connected, but the coupling is like perfect and does perfect isolation and like works out better than a trace. I mean, okay, we're really getting into the dreams here. This is not what Quilter's doing today, but it's potentially very, very exciting. But like to bring that more back to earth, one of the first things we did was actually to question the assumption of octilinear traces. From first principles, you'd think that a curved trace is typically better from a signal integrity perspective and so on and so forth. And so the boards that we've started generating were any angle traces going kind of naturally anywhere. People hated it. I've had senior engineers at companies look at that and be like, can you even manufacture those? And like, of course you can, but it's just so strange compared to what we're used to, you know, these nice 0, 90, 45 degree traces that are easy to shove around and all that stuff, that we've actually had to post-process those out and like turn our kind of any angle representation to something that's more familiar. So there's an interesting discussion here to be had about what's actually optimal from a physics perspective and like what are we used to and what are our EDA tools built optimally around?
You know, I find that really fascinating because not only do you have to convince those who are automatically have a bias against the auto router, you have to convince these other long-standing biases in electrical engineering specifically, like the angle thing. I can't tell you how many times I've heard acute angles being a problem because of acid traps in the PCB manufacturing. And from my understanding, that hasn't been a problem for decades in the PCB fabrication world. But that mentality still sticks around. And if you show the right person, or perhaps the wrong person, something that has that, they'll immediately poo-poo it and say, this is a terrible design. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of hills to climb across that.
We're talking about the electrons just can't turn that sharp of a corner and they just fly off into space. Right. What's really funny about what we're talking about here is, so some of the first circuit boards though, I mean, this is like post wire wrapping, was drawing them on transfer paper with markers. Yeah. And they're very organic. If you've seen them, they're very organic shapes. Teardrops around where the holes for your components were, because that was actually just because people were manually drill pressing through PCB. So hit tolerance wasn't very good. And so you had to have a lot of copper around it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, even a side tangent on that, like we found this, they're chopping up old Cray computers, supercomputers. And so they had some cool pictures of like the chips on them. And so the reduce the density of those chips, you went from like 100 mil spacing to 50 mil, but your PCB technology couldn't handle 50 mil hits on for through hole. And so you, they had like weird staggered dip packages. Hmm. I'll show you all the pictures later and post them in the show notes. But it's interesting from like, they could build these packages, but we didn't have the PCB technology to handle them. So they had to play games with the physical construction of how they attached. So yeah, you have all these like organic traces and stuff. And then I think what it is like some of the first EDA tools that were in the computer probably only really did 45 degrees was about what you got. And then enough people started using that. And now we have that mentality. It's interesting to go back to how it kind of originally was.
Yeah, Parker, you're completely right. When you do the math of like one of the common things that you have to do in an EDA tool and for Coulter as well is this notion of like point to line segment distance, point to point distance, or line segment distance, right? Roughly speaking, you can break the whole problem into those basic operations. The difference between whether those two line segments are axis aligned or 45 degree mitered allowed, and you consider the cases versus like any angle, it's a significantly cheaper calculation if you restrict yourself to, you know, 0, 90 degree, or even allow 45. So like when you have a 70s or 80s level computer, which is, you know, woefully slow and you're trying to do efficient operations, like, yeah, that's a very reasonable thing to do. Today, it makes absolutely no sense, but I think just the history of it is such that that's exactly what happened and we just got stuck with it. And like, you'll see, if you produce, you know, a Tikatuk, Altium, or KiCad, right? Like you can grab a trace and shove it around and everything else will move with it, as long as it's 0, 45, or 90. If you have any angle traces and you try to grab one and you try to shove it around, you're stuck. It's not going anywhere. And that's a practical pain. That's a real, actual, valid reason to kind of be forced to work with those kinds of things. But it shouldn't exist.
You know, I do wonder if these kinds of things have any kind of real basis or if they're just propagated. In other words, boards that first started using, you know, 90, 45 angles, they just worked, or perhaps they had better performance because they had better constraints or something. And the mentality that that is better without any empirical data just maybe perhaps stuck. I mean, I do agree that it's easier to route a board with 90s and 45s. And so that, you know, easy is probably going to win over optimized in most situations. But when the computer does it, do we really care? And also, can half of us, if not most of us, back up why a particular thing is better than another? I mean, to be honest, most of our experience with PCBs is we did something and it worked, therefore we keep doing it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in general, I'd love to see a lot more like math and simulations in our space. I'll give a really good example that we struggled with a lot. You know, my first year on the electromagnetic interference team at SpaceX, one of the debates you'd have a lot of PCB designers is to split ground planes or not to split ground planes and what to do with ground and like, you know, star topology and all this stuff. And it's like, people just treat it like as black magic. Like, oh, this senior person told me this is the way to do it and that's the way we're going to do it. Or I did this and it didn't work. In this case, I'm never doing it again. And like, let's just do that. But, you know, it's not, especially nowadays with today's computers and today's simulation software and, you know, GPUs and all that stuff. Like, you know, running a full Maxwell equation solver, you know, the one that we use in our stack, for a full PCB, for a noise victim query or even noise many victims query is a few minutes. I mean, it's still annoying. Like, the tooling is just such that it's annoying to set up and, you know, has to be made better and automated and all that stuff. But like, the Maxwell equations have been known for 150 years. We've had provably convergent numerical solutions to them for a half decade. We've had fast enough computers to do it in minutes for, you know, at least a decade. Let's start simulating and measuring these debates, not, you know, using best practices.
Yeah, part of your DRC stack should be the FCC rules.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool.
100%. I mean, this is not something we're seriously considering right now, but like in the long-term future of Quilter, like, shoot, I'd love to run an FCC in my lab. Like, hey, we're going to build the board and what we're going to guarantee is that you're going to pass FCC. And like, we'll test it and certify it. And if it doesn't pass, that's on us. Like, we screwed up the simulation, we screwed up the design, we'll go back, fix our engine. That's really what we care about here. Like, in a compiler world, like, where you don't have to review the design, that's what should happen. Like, the board on your desk should already be stamped for FCC approval at that point.
I mean, that just sounds like you're trying to simulate everything. You're just trying to simulate reality of the board. And that seems like a pretty daunting task. I mean, what's your confidence in that?
Yeah, well, let's take it apart. So, of course, like, when you think a priori, like, let's take the whole board and simulate it, like, oof, that's a lot. But what are we actually talking about simulating here, right? We are focused on the PCB. So what is the purpose or job of a PCB? Like, the purpose of a PCB is to faithfully recreate the intent of the schematic. And in general, the only thing that the PCB can do is either do that or fail to do that. You know, introduce some sort of parasitic or something like that that screws it up. So, okay, so then what we're really reduced with is that we have this schematic, we're assuming it's correct, right? Making a valid schematic is a different problem altogether, just like writing valid Python code is a different problem altogether to compiling it. So let's assume the schematic is logically correct. Now it's a matter of how do we make a board that faithfully recreates it? So the nice thing is that the PCB is a passive system, right? So that already reduces us to this kind of set of simulations that is just like what's basically the coupling between different geometries and not an active antenna doing something weird or responding to something weird. So the way that we think about this is that we have to understand from the schematic and the data sheet and the user, what is the signal that's propagating on every single net? We have to look at, okay, like we have a spy bus here. Cool. We have a USB here. It's a differential pair. Cool. We have a sensitive ADC and it's measuring some very, very, you know, low noise signal. And that's the thing we have to be really careful about. Cool. Great. Then we have to be aware that, like, hey, we have a switching converter here and that's going to be noisy. All right. Noted. And then we enumerate all the questions, right? So, okay, like one of the questions might be, we have the switching regulator. It's creating a whole bunch of noise. Certainly the coupling from that to the ADC is not zero. Right? The parasitics are never truly zero. But the real question is just, is it below the requirement to which it functions? You know, so with the ADC, maybe there is a requirement from, you know, the team that's creating the sensor, or maybe we just want it to be lower than the voltage range of a single bit or something like that. All right, that gives us a level. The crosstalk has to be below X, you know, minus 30 dB or something like that. So I think that it's very possible if you know all of the different signal requirements and all the different nets throughout your board to then enumerate all of those potential concerns of like, you know, I have a noise source here. I have a bunch of sensitive things here. Let's calculate the crosstalk. Let's see if it's within spec. Check, 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 check. And yeah, that's going to be thousands or tens of thousands of checks for sure. But we do it. It's possible. We do it as humans. And then we iterate until we've solved every one of them. That's kind of how we think about this. I mean, I'll frame this more in an electromagnetics perspective. There's obviously similar considerations for thermodynamics, but that's kind of how we approach it. We're not simulating what's happening inside the chip. We're taken for granted that like there is a certain signal starting at the pin. That's what's going into the PCB. The PCB is a passive element of copper and fiberglass. We can do the simulation equivalent of taking a vector network analyzer to every port and like seeing what the S parameters are and what the transfer parameters are, and then see if we've met all the constraints. And I think what would be really cool is at the end of that, let's prove our work. Let me give you as the designer, here are the S parameters you can plug into SPICE to see how your circuit's gonna perform. And then if you want to challenge it, go hook it up to a VNA and see that you got the same kind of transfer characteristics that we did.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to talk about that way. Because when we all, electrical engineers, when we design and do the layout, we are taking in account of all those things, even though we're not really thinking about it. And part of that of taking those account might be what you just talked about earlier, whereas a rule of thumb that someone learned or like a senior person has told you to do it this way. Even though you're not even applying, you know, these signal characters, you are applying a rule that takes care of that supposedly. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those, you have to start knowing more, simulating, so to speak, more about your circuit than you probably initially knew about.
Totally. I think that burden should be on us, right? Like, I think that as the user of the compiler, you should be responsible for, you know, giving us a schematic. We actually work on taking all the data sheets that came along from your schematic, downloading them, processing them, extracting information about what's on the different pins, checking it with the user, right? Like you should make sure that we've correctly understood what all your circuit is doing. But then like, why make you create that laundry list of concerns? Like we should just show it to you and say, hey, like we've thought of all of these different things. If we miss something, okay, let us know. But hopefully we haven't. I think that's where we have to get to make this kind of thing work.
It seems like you have to have, as the designer with this, you have to have far more intimate connection with your schematic than maybe we've previously asked for. Because what was going through my mind when we're talking about this is coming right out of school, I wouldn't have known half of this stuff, but I was making boards, right? And a good chunk of what I was doing was a little bit of guesstimation or just like, here's what I've learned from school, so I will apply that. But I wouldn't necessarily know what parameters to play with or what knobs I have to be able to turn in order to get exactly what I'm going for. So it seems like with this, there is perhaps a little bit of a higher threshold of what you need to know before getting into it.
Well, it does also sound like Quilter is also supposed to be, correct me if I'm going to be wrong about this, but it's also supposed to be kind of like that senior engineer helping you understand stuff about your board.
Mm. Yeah.
Or not your board, but your schematic.
Yeah, yeah. I think, Parker, you're right. Steven, I think that if you had to, like one of the reasons that auto routers have failed is that they have a lot of configuration knobs. And the designers of auto routers have just said, like, if you want this to work, go configure it. And nobody's going to do that. Mm-hmm. Never, right? You're never going to sit there and learn all these different knobs and play with them and learn what they do and read everything like that. No, it has to be easier than that. So I think, Parker, you're right that like we should actually be more like the senior engineer telling you about your board, right? A lot of the information is there, right? Like, let's say you're giving us, STM32 board. Great. As long as you've given us the part number, we have access to the data sheet. If we have access to the data sheet, we can go and query what all are the pins on this STM32 and what are their requirements. And then we'll see, okay, this needs a clock. This needs a power. This the power expects a bypass cap. This is a SPI connection. This is an Ethernet connection, you know, differential pairs. So as the junior designer, if you've never heard of a differential pair, you'll be like, okay, I guess Quilter's doing this differential pair thing. Nice. Great. Go do it. And that's the level that we should really be getting to.
Mm-hmm. No, I can get on board with that. It does seem, I agree. If the software is the gray beard that's distilling information upon you, then thumbs up.
Yeah.
It's also one of those, it will help you learn. And because this is what I found out using like ChatGPT and stuff like that is it will also, especially when you start talking technical stuff with it, it will come up with stuff you haven't thought of yet, which is, I think it's, that's, for me at least, that is AI's power, is coming up with stuff that you haven't thought about yet and, you know, implementing.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think one of the exciting things, so for today, right, like I don't want to oversell, right? Like this is a long-term vision. It's a very difficult thing to build. 60 years of efforts, nobody's done it. We've set out, we haven't completely solved it. For sure, shoot, gonna try. And, you know, we've got some great funding and great team and lots of great users giving us feedback. And we welcome more of all of the above until we eventually get there. But it's a journey, right? This is a difficult problem to solve. You know, I think the thing that we can do well now is in the limit of the easier boards, right? In the boards that are in the limit of, you know, lower frequency, lower power, where this stuff is less of a concern, we can already save a lot of time, right? So designs that take a human about a week to do, Quilter can do in an hour or maybe a couple of hours. And that's a lot of benefit to, hey, one, you don't have to spend that week. You can go do something more important, like start writing the firmware for your board or start doing some testing or validation or environmental testing or whatever else. And the second thing is that board is on your desk a week sooner, which means any gremlins or issues that are there, you find out about a week sooner and your product gets launched sooner. And that's great. That's a good start. And people are already finding a lot of value in that. However, like the stuff that excites me for the long-term potential is making better boards, right? So like what I think about is how many times when you sit down to do a layout, do you make a lot of conservative assumptions, right? If you're doing something like a flight computer or a Starlink antenna or an Apple motherboard, and you know it's going to take months, you're going to create a lot of conservative assumptions ahead of time to make sure that you get it right on close to the first try or the first try. So you might make your board a bit bigger than it has to be. You might use a more conservative stack up, you know, signal, ground, signal, ground, signal, ground, just for like perfect isolation, you know, so on and so on and so on and so forth. And what the software can eventually allow us to do is say, hey, why don't we consider 10,000 different variations? Let's consider a bunch of different stack ups. Let's consider 100 different manufacturers at the same time. Let's consider a bunch of different core materials. And let's just see like which ones actually work and where the simulations check out. And then as a designer, you're not just like getting one board across the finishing line and hopefully for the best. You can do this whole trade study of like cost versus performance versus, you know, manufacturability versus yield versus whatever else. That's where I think we as electrical engineers get superpowers, right? Where we start to very easily create much more sophisticated boards without, you know, this 3-month grueling process with 30 people reviewing it and still letting errors go by.
You know, from a nuts and bolts perspective, every time we're saying, we're taking this into account or we're considering this parameter, that's all something that seems to make the calculation explode into something much, much larger, right? Because a traditional auto router might work in a sequential manner where it says connect A to B and then go to the next trace, connect A to B and then compare. But if you're having to do all of this in parallel and consider how trace A and trace B talk to each other or don't talk to each other or whatever you're trying to accomplish, doesn't the problem become so large that it's incomputable?
So, I mean, in general, even the simpler version of this question, right? Even like, you know, bin packing or routing in a optimal way is an NP-hard problem, right? So it already is starting to explode on you, you know, exponentially, and you don't have the hope for an optimal solution. So there's two answers to this. I mean, the first is simply that as humans, we don't find the optimal answer, right? Like we are not actually holding ourselves to like, hey, this board is going to be the best possible set of atoms that could have created this schematic. We're really just going for, does it work? And does it work to meet all of our specs? So the problem isn't to find the absolute optimum typically, it's to find something sufficient for your specs. But really that still explodes. There's still a lot of considerations, there's still a lot of stuff to think about. That is what neural networks are great for. And they're not some sort of black magic that just like voodoo, solve everything. That's not really what they are. The way that I like to think of them is a lot like caching or like memory. So what you can do is you can go and create millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of boards. I'm thinking of the process here called reinforcement learning, which is how we approach this problem. And maybe the most famous example that people might lean to is what DeepMind did with the game of Go, where they beat the Go world champion in that game. The way that works is you have this neural network playing the game of Go over and over and over and over and over again. And at first, it's really dumb and making stupid decisions and could be beaten by a child. But eventually, it learns better and better and better strategies. And what it's really doing is it's not like recomputing the whole tree of all possibilities in Go. That is exponentially exploding and not computable. What it's really doing is it's kind of storing all of that previous experience in the memory of the neural network in such a way that you can interpolate previously unseen positions and make good decisions about them. So it's kind of like, imagine like a big storage cache with interpolation capability. So that's the way that we kind of solve this problem, is by generating, you know, millions and millions and millions of boards in this reinforcement learning loop with all the physics simulations, which is too expensive for any one board. We can distill that into a neural network that kind of has that experience along for the ride when it creates the next one.
So you've created just a really, really smart senior engineer that has all of this in their memory, right?
Let's say we will create that really smart senior engineer with all that in memory. The way that we break it down for now, just practically to make progress in this, is like the most extreme version of this in 100 years will be like a single neural network that takes a look at the schematic and like directly outputs copper. And that's where we might get into these like crazy shapes and these unpredictable things and blah, blah, blah. That is not how we do this today. That would not work. No chance. What we do instead is a much more practical approach, right? So we take a lot of, you know, very classically written algorithms, like, okay, like how do we detect collisions between two components? How do we detect collisions between traces? You know, how do we find a path for a trace even in a classic way? And then we allow the neural network to make high level decisions. So it's almost like you have a senior engineer standing over the shoulder of the junior engineer saying, hey, you should put this component here and this component here. And then I'm gonna go have some coffee, figure out the rest. And so the neural net is kind of that senior engineer giving that high level guidance. And then plenty of classical algorithms are still doing the low-level stuff that neural networks don't yet have the perfect precision for that would be required. But over time, like, this is the approach that Tesla took with Autopilot. In the first days, it was just a very basic net looking at a picture and millions of lines of C++ driving it. And over time, the neural network became capable of eating away more and more and more of the C++ and made a better and better, better system for driving cars. And we are very much in that progression now, and we deleted 500 lines of code just today with this kind of thing.
That deleting lines of code is, there's a software developer at Macrofab that's his favorite job, is when they make a commit, a GitHub commit, and like it just removes lines of code.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's honestly the best thing, right?
Yeah. It's less maintenance.
Yeah. Like stealing this from Elon, right? Like the best line of code is no line of code. There's no unit tests you need for it. There's no regression tests to run. You don't have to debug it. You don't have to document it. You don't have to comment it. It takes zero time to run. Like, if you can delete the line of code, still get your job done, delete the line of code.
So how does Quilter work today now? So if one of our listeners goes to quilter.ai, which is the website, this link will be in the show notes as well. What's their process? What are they going to be working through?
So the way we position this now is a lot like if you had a professional layout person that you were going to email the board to. So roughly speaking, the way it works is like this. You do your schematic. That's still on you. You select your footprints. We don't do any of that. You load that netlist and those footprints into the board file. Then it's a good idea to give us some constraints. So the first constraint that we must have is like, what is the shape of your board, right? Is it a rectangle? What size is it? Does it have cutouts? Great. The second constraint you should probably give us is you should probably place your connectors or any buttons or any screens or anything that's like mechanically defined that AI has no business doing. You place that and just leave everything else off the board, right? Like, don't worry about your stack up. Don't worry about your placement of the components. Don't worry about any of that. You basically drag and drop that file into Quilter. So if you're working on Altium, you just drag and drop the Altium file, the PCB doc. If you're working in KiCad, then it's a KiCad PCB or whatever, along with your schematic. Quilter will then ask you some questions about the constraints we can consider today. So for today, it's like live deployed, it's just power, right? So you will go through and define, for these nets, I have 1 amp, 2 amps, or I really want like a specific trace width for some reason. Great. When you click run, Quilter will pass that off to a big cluster, a bunch of GPUs, a bunch of CPUs, and go spin and do stuff. And we will generate a whole bunch of candidates. And so these candidates, you'll probably see 50, 60, 70 possible layout solutions. Some of them might not have made it to 100%, and we'll kind of hide those. You can see them if you want to, but who cares about that? And then we'll float to the top the ones that we think are the best. So they got to 100%. And then what we also do is we simultaneously compile for as many manufacturers as we can. So obviously, like in some boards, you have to go down to these 2 mil, 3 mil super fine pitch like specs that only a few manufacturers can handle. And some boards like, okay, 10 mils for everything. Anybody can fab it. Hurrah. And so we'll try all of the above, and whichever solution we got that is as flexible as possible will float to the top. And what you get is you just click a download button and you're back in Altium or you're back in KiCad. So at that point, you can open up the board. I would personally encourage you to run the DRC. If you see anything wonky, let us know. But hopefully everything's okay and you can proceed to submit to fab.
So what are some of the challenges that come along with trying to do this?
Oh, man. I don't even know where to begin. There's a lot of challenges. On just the business side, right? You know, we've turned this into a venture-backed company by raising money and convincing investors. Historically, it's been difficult to do, right? Historically, investors have considered EDA as a small market, and especially when it's applied to PCBs and not chips. And so just getting sufficient funding for something that is this difficult but considered small market, that was a challenge. Another challenge is that, in general, I ask myself, why doesn't this exist yet? And, you know, why is there such a proliferation of tools in the software space that hasn't happened in electronics? And I think the answer is that in software, the people who use those tools can build them for themselves. Whereas electrical engineers are not typically programmers or not typically like amazing programmers, right? So now our team has a whole bunch of folks who are amazing at software, but don't know much about electronics. And then people who are amazing at electronics, but don't write a whole lot of software. And so like gluing that social world together is a challenge and it's very important, but very exciting and very fun. And then technically speaking, there's a lot of challenges, right? I mean, all of this stuff is difficult. You know, computational geometry is deceptively difficult to do correctly. Writing the basic operations and then making them fast is okay, a straightforward engineering task. But like trying to come up with strategies and planning and figuring out how to train the neural nets in ways that they actually learn, I don't know how to say it. It's just difficult. You try things and they don't work a lot. And you try again and they don't work a lot. And you read papers and you try those things and those don't work either. And it's just a slog. But we're making progress on it for sure.
How do the engineers or your community, like, how do they give you feedback? Is there like just is there a like button? Or is there a thumbs down? How does that work?
So we encourage as much feedback as possible, right? Quilter is an open beta. Anybody's welcome to come use it. There's no restrictions. You don't have to pay for it. Like, please go break it. Great. We have a chat on every single window. You can open it. You'll see one of us and you can tell us how much you like it or hate it immediately. We have little buttons that are specifically like, please give us feedback. We have a community forum. We're hoping to start a Discord here pretty soon. We are as welcome. I mean, like, and we also exist on Twitter and on LinkedIn and whatever else. Like, please come give us constructive criticism left and right. The main thing we're doing right now is looking for people who also believe in this long-term vision and want to help us make it so. So we encourage in every way. It's funny. We've thought about doing some sort of like ranking or thumbs up, thumbs down or something like that, like a hot or not for boards. We haven't done it yet, but it's a good idea. It's come up before.
Swipe right for good layouts.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, how does that feed back into training the neural net then? It's clear that's probably not like the user isn't directly doing that part of it. So how do y'all do that on your end?
I mean, the other consideration here is that, you know, people are generally sensitive about their designs and you would hate to like have, you know, upload your design, have us train on it and suddenly make decisions on somebody else's board based on your design. Like, that's not cool. So we don't do that. That's one of the nice things about reinforcement learning is we actually don't learn from any human data whatsoever. We are just taking in, here is this game of playing PCB design. Go play it, agent. And then we score you based on what matters, which is this board manufacturable? Do the physics check out? Is it going to work? Right? That's really what matters is like, did you make this board manufacturable? And is this board going to work when you build it? That's the score. Now, there is an interesting debate to be had about, should we be trying to make these boards aesthetic? Right? I would argue that in most boards, that doesn't matter. Maybe if you're NVIDIA or Apple and your board is going to be taken apart, people are going to take pictures of it, like the top and bottom layer, it's important to be aesthetically pleasing. But in general, that shouldn't matter. But that's not something we've solved. Like we don't have a beauty score that feeds into the system at this point. And that's evident in the results.
Before I was introduced to you, Sergi, through email, some people in a car Discord were using Quilter.
No way. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I saw the outputs and I'm like, that looks like a board from like the 60s in terms of like, it's just organically just like a tree. And everyone was like, this looks really weird. And I'm like, well, this is like kind of like how boards used to look like. Because, you know, most people don't realize, like Steve and I are too young to have done boards that way. And I've only had that experience because I've taken apart old stuff. And Steven, probably because of amplifiers. Old amplifiers are that way.
Well, yeah, I've seen a good bit of it. And I hand-etched my college project, so it had some organic issues with it. You mentioned Apple needing something aesthetic. I bet if you did do the curved trace thing or whatever with Apple, there would be headlines saying like electronics reimagined, or they've reinvented the electronics going back to back to their roots or whatever. You know, earlier you mentioned that Maxwell's equations. Are you actually computing Maxwell's equations for across the board?
To date, yes, and I consider it a mistake, unfortunately. So in the long term, I think that's what we should be doing, right? In the long term, like the Maxwell equations are the source of the truth, right? So we should just solve them properly, and let's not deal with any approximations and where those approximations might be faulty and all that stuff. And that's the way we approached it. Like our first solver that we plugged in, that we, you know, trained nets on at some point and experimented with, was a full solver, right? Like it's a full, no approximations made, like, you know, FDTD type solver. The problem is it's just too slow. That's the unfortunate thing. Like when you have to take 5 to 6 minutes for a single query on even a small board, it's just not quite good enough. So we are now, we can't use it as much as we want to in the solver. And for that reason, we are putting a pause on that one and considering like, all right, well, why don't we go back to the quasi-static approximation? That's probably going to be the next thing that we do is just, all right, like, basically assume the time doesn't exist and let's extract capacitance and mutual inductance, you know, and steady state currents. And let's see how far we can get with that. And I think that it's a valid approach. I think we can start with that. We can train the agents to be pretty darn good with that and then fine tune with this more expensive full Maxwell equation solution later on. But yeah, but as a physicist and a purist, I wanted to go for the full Maxwell equation solution. And that was probably not the right decision at first.
So let's say Quilter takes over the world of electrical engineering and everyone is on board with this. I noticed on your website you had a note on there that said that hardware engineers spend 50% of their time doing layout. And if they're not doing that, how do you see the role of hardware engineering evolving?
I think like this question is frequently asked out of the fear of like, oh no, what's going to happen to my job? Like, what am I going to do? Right. And I think like this question is going to be really relevant in the age of AI and in the age of automation. And historically, it's always turned out favorable. I mean, there's short-term disruption, right? Like when, you know, you come in and your specific job is automated away for a specific person, that might be difficult. I don't think Quilter is going to like suddenly wake up tomorrow and have a GPT-4 moment and everything is doomed. Like, you're fine.
You're telling me we can't party now 50% of our time?
No. No. If you only design boards that are like sub 2000 pins and sub 500 megahertz, then sure. But in general, no. But, you know, I think that there's today already such a shortage of electrical engineering talent, right? Like a lot of people are graduating college and being like, screw this, I'm going to go learn software because it pays better and it's easier. And so the hardware companies are stuck. Like you've got, you know, an aging population who's getting ready to retire in these fields. Not that many people coming in. I just saw this morning, I think it was the CEO of Intel a couple of years ago posted a chart of like, you know, in 1980, you know, like everybody was graduating with an EE degree, like in this space, and like 10% of people were a CS degree. Now it's exactly the opposite, right? Like there's like 10 times as many CS people as there are EE people. So I think there's no shortage of work to go around, right? Let's get all those people contributing to schematic side, getting boards done faster. You know, how many times at SpaceX did we have, you know, like we were testing some chip and all we could do is like string together some breadboards and some breakout kits and some horrible stuff. And then like when you carry it from one lab to the next, some wire comes loose and you spend 2 hours debugging like why that happened and before you can do your test. Like like, no, like now that it's easy, let's just make a schematic real quick and make throw together a board and then have it be reliable. You know, I think that that's what's going to happen. Like, I think that those folks who are currently PCB layout experts can move into a schematic or go into firmware or go into test engineering or go into environments or any of the other fields that are critically important to designing PCBs. And we need them. There's a shortage. Like, This is not going to be like a lose your job, nothing for you to do. There's so many other things to do.
Yeah, on top of that, it's the just the CHIPS Act alone in the United States is 600,000 engineering jobs that we need in the next 4 years. And we've talked about this previously on the podcast. It's at our current rate, it would take us 20 years to fill all those positions, and we have to do it in four.
Wow.
So it's like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's even worse than you think, Sergi.
No, thank you for telling me. I did not know that. That's remarkable.
Yeah, we've been saying right now is a fantastic time to go get a double E degree because there's jobs waiting for you right at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why I view AI as something that's super helpful and just helps you automate parts of your job that end up repeating. Like what you're saying is routing a board, a computer should be really good at that, right?
Absolutely. And hey, I know people who think of layout as therapeutic, who do layout as a way to kind of stay calm and you know, process their day. And you can always do that.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's fine. But yeah, in cases where like you need results, you need the board fast. I mean, at SpaceX, right? Like we valued one day, if you could cut a day out of critical path by spending $100,000, that was an easily smart decision. Like, obviously go do that. Because one day of critical path is much more expensive than that, right? And so if we're talking about cutting weeks or months out of critical path, it's a no-brainer. You know, in those applications where engineers could be doing something better and can get the product out that much faster, like, of course, let's do this.
You know, what I vision here is, because you talked about how Quilter will output multiple designs. Is I'm viewing this as you take those multiple designs and you build them, all of them, and then you validate them in real life with all your parameters, put them in all your test equipment and that kind of stuff. And that is super powerful. And that's something you just can't do right now, right? Because that's the whole thing with software, where we're talking about the compile button, right? Where it's so quickly to validate and change your design if it doesn't work. But in hardware space, it's minimal a couple days just to get a piece of hardware. And usually it's like a week to 2 weeks to get a piece of hardware on your desk. So if you can go, hey, I want to try 10 iterations right now, you can't do that.
I want to get to the point where like we know this is the best candidate and it's going to work. But until then, yeah, that's valid. That's a cool idea. I haven't thought about it that way.
It's funny because I was just about to bring up the exact same thing. And this is something I've never had to do before. It just doesn't really make sense. But if you had three different layouts, let's say, and you wanted to build 30 boards, 10, 10, and 10 of each, they all have the same parts. It wouldn't surprise me if you could work a deal with your contract manufacturer where they leave all the parts on their machines and they just load this layout, do it, load the next layout, do it. You know, they do have to do a changeover on the program and things like that, but you may save actually a little bit of money and you could try three different layouts.
You could do it as one board, right? Like you could just make it a panel where like the panel True. Has one of each shape
True.
And then it's just one PCB mm-hmm. placement pass and then it's the same parts. And yeah, I mean, this would be a cool way to experiment with like how small can we make a board, right? Like let's try 10 different sizes from fairly big to like as dense as we can possibly make it. And then like, what's the smallest one that actually works and is reliable and high yield and bring up? Like, okay, that's the one we're going with. Cool.
As long as you have the money to do it.
So for those interested in trying Quilter, Sergi, where can people go and get started working on it?
Yeah, easiest place is quilter.ai in your browser. If you search for Quilter, PCB, AI, something, something in Google, you'll definitely find us. You know, if you search for my name on LinkedIn or Twitter, you'll find me there as well. And the links lead back to it.
Again, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and talking about Quilter.
Oh, thank you, guys. Stephen Parker, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Circuit Break. We're your hosts, Parker Dolman.
And Stephen Craig.
Later, everyone.
Take it easy.
Thank you, Yes You Are Listener, for downloading our podcast. Tell your friends and coworkers about Circuit Break, the podcast from MacroFab. If you have a cool idea, project, or topic you want us to discuss, let Steven and I and the community know. Our community, where you can find personal projects, discussions about the podcast, engineering topics, and news, is located at forum.macrofab.com.